perverted every way. A dog will have his day, but when it comes to wailing, dogs ain't got a thing to say. So they can do the waiting, cause I ain't hesitating. The future's round the corner, so for now I'm gonna play. Now's the time to wail, not later, but right now's the time.
Elvira Vi Red on alto sax and vocals, opening her famous Now's the Time. It's from her 1962 album, Bird Call, dedicated to her great hero, Charlie Parker, who heavily influenced her work. And she is a pioneer of women in jazz, and of course she selected the alto sax as her instrument. On this, we also hear Leroy Vinegar on bass, Richie Goldberg, who was then her husband, on drums, Russ Freeman on piano, Herb Ellis on guitar, Carmel Jones on trumpet, Roy Ayers on vibraphone. This is Lead Stories. I'm your Trace Lead. And we had an avalanche of calls yesterday from listeners wanting to participate in the discussion, and we're not able to get on the air. So today, we just expand the conversation to give everybody a chance to say something. And the something has to do with what you're thinking about the time that we're in. The race is in its home stretch. The presidential race is in the home stretch. And we're really not as concerned about who is winning, who is losing. That stuff is, you know, that's not the stuff that we are looking for here. We're looking for ways in which your political consciousness has been developing and where you are right now with it as you observe this race and all the issues associated with it. How have you changed in your thinking about politics? And how have you changed in your own political orientation? Even if you just a little tweak, what is it? How have you come to view the political process? And to that degree, what instruction is this presidential race giving you about the political process and about what you think you need to do now, having arrived at a certain understanding of it? And in that understanding, are you changing the way you see things? And if so, if it's changing the way you see things, how do you think it's going to impact your future political consciousness and action? And that's really what we're looking to deal with. We know and we should accept certain things about this race. It's really abominable. it's awful. And it seems to have crystallized everything that people we criticize about the political process. It's been very undemocratic. It is so removed from people's daily experiences. It does not honor this idea that we're all in this together and we have a role to play. It is a kind of an orchestrated, choreographed charade. And we get that. But it's not enough to get that. It is important to understand systems because we are all affected by systems, this political system. But what is your understanding of it? And how is it going to change or in some way affect the way you operate, your political consciousness? What are you likely to do as a result of this consciousness? Are you aware that you have a new political consciousness? 888-874-4888 is the number to call. And again, this, I believe, is an excellent way for us to gauge for ourselves. I mean, we are political scientists. We live politics all the time, every single day. We don't have to wait for anybody to tell us what is going on. We know it. We see it, we feel it, we experience it every single day. But it's not enough just to know it. What are we doing with this knowledge? And what do you see as a possibility for creating a system of our own? I'm saying our because I think if we put bits and pieces together, we could come up with something that's workable and that would have the net effect of being good for a whole group of people. But we first have to understand the system. What is it about? What is it doing to us? And do we have any authority at all? Do we have any way of kind of stopping or fixing this? Is it even fixable? What are your thoughts? We had quite a few people yesterday just relating, I mean, really deep political science via their own experiences. And they thought they were just telling, you know, their personal stories. But they are actually deconstructing a very complex system because in the end it boils down to your individual interaction with it and its interaction with you. And then we could see how on a larger scale this actually impacts our society. What is this thing that we have called politics? What is it? Government, what is it? What has it come to mean? And do we have to live with this? Is there no other way that we could approach this business of governance, which actually should be a healthy relationship between those who give power and those who get power to help us live more harmoniously as a society? Whatever happened to those concepts? What are your thoughts? 888-874-4888 is the number to call. And we're listening because we're taking instruction from you about what politics, in effect, ends up being to the citizen. What is this relationship that we have? What is this system and method of governance that we have? Is it relevant any longer? Is it serviceable any longer? Is it to the benefit of the people any longer? Or should we come to a different way of operating? And that brings up the question of the voting, the right to vote and the power of the vote and all of these cliches that we are bombarded with at this time when elections are in full swing. Is voting the answer? Is not voting the answer? Is voting differently the answer? And if we're voting differently, how differently are we voting? The operative thinking, I think, is that we see government, and this is how we have been conditioned as a society, to see government as a thing separate and apart from us. It's its own organism, a breathing organism that has all these different component parts, but together is a powerful force over our lives. We've grown accustomed to that as the standard definition. There's us, and then there is this thing called government that governs. Have we not been able to move a little closer to a different definition, which is government? We are government. We do have the power of the throttle and the brake. We just never envisioned it as a right. We never envisioned it as even a potential that we have within our grasp, the throttle and brake. We hand that power almost automatically over to this thing called government, or whatever system of government happens to be prevailing in our town or city or country at the time. But in fact, that huge power is the amalgamation of smaller units of power. And we are the smaller units of power. We lend and we give and we consign our power to this system. But over the course of time, I think we are entitled to ask whether that is a good system. It's not been working very well for everybody. And now it has become a thing of expectation. This is what you will do because somebody decided that, you know, we'll define it as a constitutional right and a civic duty to vote. So you'll go and vote. But you're not necessarily thinking about what you're voting for. You're thinking about who you're voting for. As if you recognize that the who is also the system. But it isn't. The system prevails irrespective of whom we put into office. The system is what prevails. And that has not been designed by us. We have had no part in it at all. Okay, you have to start somewhere. The so-called founding fathers came up with a system. Well, obviously, they're not going to come up with a system that would eventually dislodge them and challenge their power. So they came up with a system that aggregates power to them, that class, the ruling class, and they were very clear about that. But in the interest of seeming to be very, very all-embracing and all-encompassing, they give people the illusion that you are participating in this, in the decision of who gets to rule. And we know that that's not true. We're not participating in who gets to rule. That's already been decided. So in that sense, to me, it's just a matter of conjecture talking about whether you're going to elect Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. It's the same class with the same concerns, the power elite, even though by themselves they never would have qualified as being members of the power elite in this country. But there are concessions that are made to let people in who, if it's necessary, but they must, of course, pledge to maintain the system. And in this case, both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton clearly pose no threat in that regard to the system. They're not going to change fundamental things. So it comes back to us. The people who are carefully herded and choreographed to play this predetermined role, you show up on election day, so that there could be a rational explanation for what happened in terms of the transference of power. We the people would have, on election day, we would have been said to have given license to the power elite again to rule over us. And in fact, that would be true. That would be true. From time to time, and we saw a little sputtering of that with Bernie Sanders, we saw the sputtering of that, but we discussed this before, of other movements, the Green Party, the Libertarian Party this time around, and other parties, making an effort to bring this level of consciousness to people that we really do have the power. And we should flex our muscle in our interest. So let's get that conversation going, because this is what political science is all about. The science of it. This is not about just thinking what we feel. And, you know, this is not a personal thing. There's a science to it. What is your version of that science? Ed from Queens, you get to start us off today. Ed, you're on the air.
You hear me?
Yes.
Hello. Oh, yeah. How you doing? I didn't know if you could hear me or not. Basically, as far as my political philosophies, I mean, this is the lowest point that I have ever seen in politics in this country. I mean, we have two candidates who basically are of ill moral repute. So I don't see how anything good can come out of this election. The only good thing that I'm starting to see is with people, the conversation is changing. Words like socialism, words like cooperative, due to Richard Wolff and even what Bernie Sanders did in the beginning, the mindset of the American people is opening now. And there's discussions going on, and there's ideas that 20 or 30 years ago never would have even saw the light of day. So I think that germ or that seed that's been planted is definitely a plus. I don't know where it's going to go. I don't think anything's going to happen in my lifetime. I'm 49. But I see the beginnings of maybe some real system change, because I don't believe the system can be repaired. I think it needs to be completely destroyed. And we need to start with something new that really services the people in general. And this system just doesn't have that capability anymore.
For yourself, personally, do you feel that you have been changing your political outlook, and from what to what?
I started my political awakening with my cousin. He's a black national, so I've always been partial to black nationalism, Garveyism. Now I see more of a, as I get older, I see more of a, for want of a better word, a more holistic view of it. You know, it's not just about nationalism on a specific race or a specific nationality. It's more of a rich versus poor, which is what it always has been if you look at it historically. There's always been more people who don't have than people who have. And the people who have found ways to trick the people who don't have into fighting amongst themselves and not representing a common interest. So my political views have changed that way over the years.
And let's say, I accept that. How will this change in your political outlook change your political actions? I mean, how do you express what you're thinking in what you're doing?
Well, I work with different organizations. Basically, I work with a media organization called CPR Metro. One of your colleagues, Bernard White, started it after he left the other station. And we record lectures, we perform, we do public town meetings, things like that. We've got some stuff planned with Gloria Brown Marshall in October. And we also got a town hall event coming up at NNN on September the 30th, where I'm a producer. So I try to, in that, try to provide media. I think this is a time for education. I think there are a lot of people coming to the political process that don't really, they're hearing a lot of things like socialism, cooperative economics, co-ops, things like that are words to them now, but they don't really understand the meaning behind them. So I think with that, we can educate now. So in the not too distant future, hopefully, things will change.
Well, thank you. Thanks, Ed, for getting us started today and for contributing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We go to New Jersey. Michael, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Eutrice.
Hello.
Hope you're well.
Thanks. I'm trying.
And I hope the rest of the audience is well. And, when we talk about political freedom, I think, or just politics or our political consciousness, I think we have to realize what a complex issue this is. It doesn't lend itself really to some kind of a definition or some conclusion, because it's a process. It's something that's going on, and it's a source of great confusion, because all that confusion seems to be around actually power itself. We always end up talking about power, and it always goes back to that issue when it comes to politics. And even in the beginning, you had a right course on what you said about does this have to be? Can we find a new way of existing, a new way of being together? And I think that's what's leading to perhaps a new paradigm. Oftentimes, we feel that some system that we impose on ourselves is going to have a definitive, or be a solution to all of our problems. And I think they've tried that with communism. They've said, let's forget about what human beings are inside themselves, their consciousness, etc. Let's just provide a system, and they'll live in that system, and they'll be happy. And that didn't work, really. So, on the other hand, interestingly, I'll just go off on a little aside. I was in Brooklyn just this past weekend, and they had this little house where George Washington sort of stopped the British for a while and escaped across the river there into Manhattan. And I was reading the various plaques in there about the 1700s in Brooklyn and what was going on. And I was interested to find out that one-third of the population of Brooklyn in the 1700s were slaves. And it was such a contradiction that the ruffians, patriots, were running in, and the poor people in Brooklyn were farmers, but they were living in an existence that they'd become, adapted to. And they bought slaves, and the slaves, that was their labor, and they were farmers in Brooklyn back in the 1700s. And one-third of the population were slaves, and there were these farmers, and most of the people weren't too happy with the patriots that were, rampaging through Brooklyn. And they'd come in and they demand their, food and lodging and everything else. And actually, the first people that freed the slaves, according to what I learned in this little museum of a reconstructed 1700s house, that there was there the Miller House or something. And the fact is that the first people that freed the slaves were the British. But it was a give-to-get situation. They said, well, we declare you free, all the slaves that live in Brooklyn, because, of course, the British came in and occupied Brooklyn for 7 years. And they freed the slaves as long as the slaves were against the Patriots and you know, fought with the British. So it wasn't without it wasn't a free. It was free if. And but I thought it was all very interesting. But it's always this. But the contradiction was startling that these people were fighting against King George there because they were enslaved. They felt impinged, enslaved by King George. In the meantime, these people were slave owners. They owned people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's a glaring contradiction, even from the very beginning of this country. And you know, I just learned some of these things just sitting, you know, walking through that little museum and reading the plaques. Things I never knew.
Well, let's go back to your observation about communism not working. Communism, you said, had tried to turn things around, but it could not overcome individual orientation to basically sharing power. And the individual foibles contributing to the... I don't know that I would agree that necessarily communism failed. I think the concept still is a viable one, but again, people moved away from the concept. It's very tempting to still... in a situation where you say, well, let's pool everything and let's see if we can get a more even distribution, there are people who will still be oriented toward my power is to be reflected by having more than the other. So this is what's going on. How
right.
has your political orientation changed? Is it changing at all? And from what to what?
It's, you know, that's why I was saying it's so complex. It's continuously changing, you know, because it's this whole thing that I keep coming back to with power. Even at the very beginning, you said that, you know, giving power, you know, having power and then giving it to those, you know, to those in the government. But, you know, in our way of government, it's not supposed to be like that. The power is supposed to be always with the people. And it's only used through the process of representation, but it's still our power. They represent us, but it's our power. But the problem is that they've taken power for themselves, the politicians. And they've concentrated power. So as I look to the right and to the left, you know, I don't place myself anywhere. I'm trying to understand our relationship with one another, and it's always mediated our relationship by power. And power, you know how I feel about power, but it's such a contradiction because people generally know that power corrupts and absolute power, it's such an old saying, absolute power corrupts power, you know, completely. But yet, everybody's fighting over power. Everybody wants power.
Well, they're fighting over what they perceive to be power. And this is the other thing. Is the power that they're looking for, this absolute power, I mean, are they the only ones who have it or look for it? There's a lot of power. Right now, for example, right this minute, the most distressed segments of our society have actually the greatest power to determine the outcome, and they don't seem to know it.
That's right.
The African-American vote, the Latino vote, these are the levers that are going to determine what happens.
Right, and they're confused
on
the right and the
power.
Left, as I see it.
Huh?
I say they're confused on the right and the left. The people in Kansas, they say, what's the problem with Kansas? Remember that book or whatever it was? Why are they voting against their own interests? And then we have the spectacle of the African Americans voting against their best interests and throwing their lot with Hillary Clinton. So there's a confusion, right?
Well, it would appear to be
both
confusing
on the right and the left.
But that's from our point of view. From their point of view, it's quite logical.
Right.
In their view, their thing is because we've been conditioned about this thing about winners. We like winners, and you want to be on the side of winners. How many decades have gone into priming people to accept that as a rationale for how to vote, as opposed to what you just said, your interests? What are your interests?
Right.
Not what do you want to be on the winning side? And look who we have on the so-called winning side. I mean, is this a winning ticket? I don't think so. And yet, we have to appreciate the fact that people are giving a lot of thought to this, and they are voting absolutely against their interests, but they are voting consciously, thinking that this is the best choice. They don't want to hear all the other things. They don't want to hear about the history of Hillary Clinton or the history of Donald Trump and you know, discrimination against the African-American community. And they don't want to hear all of that.
They think it's their interest.
It is in their interest to be on the winning side. And that is enough, to be on the winning side.
And you see the way that they divide. I mean, Hillary Clinton, what does she call it? The intolerables?
The deplorables.
The deplorables.
Yeah.
I mean, this is so funny. It is like Romney, you know, dividing up the country, the 47%. She's done the same thing on the other side. Now, I know the liberals are saying, no, that's not a fair comparison. But really, if you look at it, she's divided the thing in half just like he did, hoping his half is a little bit bigger than the other half.
But that's how, when you really look at power, raw power, it isn't very complicated. They don't deal with very complicated things. They like things that are very straightforward and simple, mathematically understandable, because the simpler, the better, the easier to control. If it gets to be too complicated, it becomes too unpredictable. And systems are meant to simplify things.
And isn't it because that the voting population, the public, is confused? And that
no, I wouldn't say they're confused.
Kind of
look, the population is exactly what it has been conditioned to be. When we say that they're confused, we're giving no credit at all to the fact that we are all up against a mega machine that has spent a lot of time, a lot of money, and a lot of science in figuring out how to control your entire life. So people can be made to do anything because there's a science to it. I spent a very, I was laughing at myself actually, doing laundry, and I was having the bane of my existence is folding a fitted sheet. I can't do it.
No, me neither.
So what you do is, you know, you fold whatever you could fold, and then you grab your fitted sheet in one little bundle.
You make the
and
best
you,
of
you
it.
Hurry to the bed and you put it on the bed right away.
Right.
And that's how you fold the fitted sheet. But this lady saw me wrestling with this idea, and she also saw me giving up. And she said, look, here's how you fold the fitted sheet. And it was like magic. The difference was I had no science about it.
Right.
And it's a very simple thing, actually.
Right.
But
right.
I had no knowledge of how to do that simple thing. And she did.
Mm-hmm.
And that made all the difference in the world. Now, if we were to get more complicated and find, well, do you have a college degree? Do you have The fact is, I needed to fold a fitted sheet and didn't know a thing. I couldn't tell you how to do it. And yeah. I've never done it successfully over many, many years. And that is because I have been, I've been the perfect foil for the industry. You want a fitted sheet, and you buy a fitted sheet, it's nice and square when you get it in the store, and it's perfect.
And that's the last time it is that way.
It's the last time you would see it that way. But there are people who, the industry, like in the hotel industry and so forth, there's a science to folding a sheet. A simple thing like that. So it's the same with the in general application. We are the byproduct of our conditioning, and there's a lot that has gone into and still goes into conditioning us all.
Exactly.
And so we and are
the
byproducts
side,
of that. We just have to.
Studying.
This is why we're talking to figure out. Have we, how much have we caught on to the game? And to what degree does this enable us to move beyond the predicted path that we are supposed to be taking in life? And this is where we are. Thanks so much. Great
you're
talking
welcome.
With you, Michael.
Good talking with you.
Thanks a lot. David from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Yes, nice to reach you again, Yatrice.
Thank you.
A couple of things come to mind. You know, when the so-called founding fathers decided to write this Constitution and do the things they could do at that time, I don't think their idea was to make this a democracy and a government run by the people. I don't think that was their idea at all, to have a situation where the politics and the economics were run by the masses in any way. Now, also, with this election situation that we have going on, as we know, it's run by the ruling class, and they allow the people to vote. This is no different than being on a slave plantation owned by some person who stole the land from the indigenous people and allowing the slaves to vote who will be the overseer, overseer A or overseer B. That's Trump for Clinton. That's all it is. They selected who was going to be able to run for president, and then they let the slaves decide, or the people in this case, decide who they will have on the ballot and allow them to go to, or even a prison of the head of the prison system allows the prisoners to vote on who's going to be the warden. So you pick one Trump or one Clinton. One or the other. The system is a capitalist system, and that has one goal in mind, to make profit for the people who run the economics of the country. And that's what we have here. And the people that live here are not supposed to be the real beneficiaries of the economic system that we have. So you're never going to have a government of, by, and for the people under this capitalist system that we live in. Now, in terms of what changes I've made, in this way a long time, I started to really learn after I got out of college and.
Have we lost David? Oh, David, I'm sorry, we lost you. Please call back and finish your thought. Rudy from Montreal, you're on the air.
Hello, Yatrice. Was wondering, isn't it really time that the electorate went on a strike against this rigged electoral system? the electoral process, in which over 1.5 or 2 million votes are never even counted. People who are counting them don't have any experience. Why isn't it that the federal government runs the elections instead of the states? It seems that people have to now hold the candidates actually accountable for the platforms that they're making. And then it should, you know, when there's a speech, if no one shows up, well, maybe the message will get there that, you know, they're not going to be handed this excrement. And when the candidates come on the street and glad hand you, maybe you don't want to be to have the baloney. You have to take your hand away as if it is excrement, because you know that it's just a false handshake and that this person has no intention of helping to bring a platform that will help the people who are thrown out of their houses or are living homeless. This vote is just as important as the civil rights. People have to get together and say, look, we're just not going to be taken to the cleaners by you people who promise one thing and deliver another. We've got to turn our backs to these candidates when they make promises you know they're not going to keep. Isn't this better? I mean, how can you go around illegally disenfranchising voters? It's a disrespect for their fundamental freedoms and rights. Surely people could, I know it's dangerous. The black people had to demonstrate in Washington, and Martin Luther King was murdered, possibly by the top people, because he was going to be too effective and they couldn't control the people. Imagine that they're wiping people out just for exercising their freedom. What is wrong here? Can you tell me?
Well, we know systems behave. They're living, breathing organisms. They have their own agendas. They have their own ways of executing those agendas. I worry more about what the people are thinking and doing. I worry more about developing new ideas and new ways of doing things that challenge this system, which is never going to yield. It in my view, it just will not yield to the concept that you're talking about of egalitarianism, where people literally benefit from an organized system of government. So the question really is, insofar as the system depends on the contribution of power, it amasses power by people contributing their individual power to this system of governance, what do you do with that power, this individual power that you have? What do you do with it to create something that works at least a little better than what we have now? And we do have that power. The system isn't all powerful. We give it that power. We give it that life. But we do have our own power. What do we do with it? How do we harness it? First, we have to identify it and believe that it actually belongs to us. When do we arrive at that point? I don't know. But it is worth discussing.
Let me put it this way. If those in power so fear the people that they have to eliminate the spokespeople for civil rights and freedoms, if they're so fearful, then they know that people can utilize these demonstrations by Martin Luther King and others in the civil rights movement changed entirely, because people are, whether they're politicians or crooks, they have children, they have mortgages, they want work, they have to, so they're, even if they don't want to change, their children are going to change. Their children vote. Well, that's why it's so important that people vote, but they have to make sure that it's counted properly. You know, my vote counts, so you better count it correctly and stop this voter fraud. This is an enormous problem that people are being elected, which the electorate never had any intentions of voting, but because of the rigging of it. But these people in the media, they have children. They have feelings. They go to church. They understand fear. So it just starts with one to have courage to bring other people together. And it will, I mean, listen, in Iran, nobody ever heard of this guy Khomeini. Nobody. But they passed tapes of his speech from person to person. And throughout, apparently, I don't know, but apparently a very vicious government. The Soviet people, now the Russian people, they overturned the government with no real death and destruction, because those in power refuse to listen. And if they know what's going on, Obama, I fell in love with Obama. This guy was, I said, here's a person that knows what the problem is. So he has to have people to support him, no matter what your position is.
How'd it turn out?
Well, people, how did it turn out? In Iran, it turned out very well. In Russia, it turned out very well. But there is a massive alphabet letter of organization that could turn your life into a nightmare. But even they have children. Even they have feelings. No matter how ugly and no matter how psychopathic, not everyone is psychopathic. It just takes a number of people, and then what is the saying? Build the baseball stadium, and then people will come. Build the courage in a few, and many will follow.
Well, let's hope some people are listening to that today, because we desperately need to build something different. Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
David, you're back, so you can finish your point.
Well, I don't know. Let's see. I'm thinking about what was, just said. And I think the important thing is to get across to everyone, or they should learn by now, there's absolutely no hope in staying with the Republican and Democratic Party. People need to get to the point where they have a party of workers, not workers joining in with a party completely controlled by the oligarchs who run most of the levers of society. Workers have to get to the point, and that's the masses of people that live here, that they have to get out of the oligarchs' parties, and both of those capitalist parties, the Democrat and the Republican parties, are in that category. And we, the people, need to get out of those parties, abandon them completely. That's what we have to do, one of the things we have to do. And if we're going to have parties, we have to establish the parties that are run by us and not by those people at the very top. There's absolutely no hope in reforming either of those capitalist parties that run most things in this country. This is just out of the question. So we've got to come to that reality.
Thank you for coming back to us and finishing your thought.
From
Thank Wisconsin, you very much. Habu, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello, good afternoon, and thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I quite serendipitously came across your shows, and they are replete with very careful and insightful, trenchant analysis. And that is what we should be doing in trying to dissect this morass. But that doesn't happen in the mainstream media, and the people go along with it gleefully. But that having been said, if I may just offer an observation, you know, the only comparison I can make is the majority, the American public are living in steerage class below the decks. And when we have somebody who offers a little bit of hope, such as initially Trump and then Bernie Sanders, there was such a momentum of action, and there was excitement in the air, not because these people had the proper solutions, but just that there was an opportunity to do something different than the tried and the same old that has proved destructive almost progressively, you know. So I also think that as the general standard of living goes down and down and down, as is happening with little incidents like lead in the Flint water system, and here and even in Milwaukee, it just came out that 50,000 houses have that same problem. Yet they can't; the government cannot provide any funds for it, let alone EPA and the president doing anything. Once upon a time, these would have been major clarion calls to hear lead in the water. So this is happening progressively, while you know, major military expenditures go on unabated. The old guns and butter from the 60s question still vexes us, and it's business as usual. And the worst people are the main parties who just poo-poo any kind of alternative analysis, such as the one you've been providing. I just want to end with this. I initially thought Trump provided a ray of light, but I'm beginning to think twice. And the other candidate was just out of the question. But I just read just today that he's going to have Woolsey, who used to be the CIA head and who was one of the major propagators of the invasion to Iraq. And so this almost is a new person comes on the scene, and then they get snowed by all this glitz of the old system, you know.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, how has your political outlook changed, if at all?
Well, prior to this primary election, I had abstained. I had a hiatus from voting. I saw Obama come on, and I did vote for him, although I could see through his lies. I remember the Progressive magazine here in May of 2008 during the primary quoted Adolf Reed, which said something like, he is a vacuous opportunist. And I could see right through that from what he said about his planks and whatever. Yet the mainstream media was going gaga. So I just kind of detached myself, and I thought the most important metric that could make any difference is to stay away from the elections when the number of the percentage of people voting is, say, 20-25%. Then the United States has no business going anywhere around the world, much less using a barrel of a gun to tell people to be democratic, you know. So mm-hmm. I thought that would be the only meaningful metric that could bring about change.
Well, I want to thank you for this call. I'm so delighted to have you with us. I'm glad that you happened upon us accidentally, but that you are with us. That's great. And that brings us to the end of the program today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Stay tuned. Coming up next, The Infectious Myth with David Crow. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know what you think of this program. And I'm seeing more people queued up who should have some kind of space to express themselves. So we'll continue the conversation. I like that. I like it. This, by the way, is what radio should be for, which is to encourage people to think out loud and to trade ideas and information and opinions and thoughts with each other, because this is peer-to-peer education. This is political science. We have been fortunate to have, and at no cost. That's the best thing, no cost. Thank you all for participating and contributing at such a high level, which is customary here. I really appreciate that. A pleasure always and a great privilege to be in your company, and we'll go at it again tomorrow. Bye-bye.